Good evening. Do I need? Oh, that was good. Good evening. I never knew such words could have such a powerful effect in a noisy room of happy people. Welcome to Episcopal Church of the Transfiguration. We are very glad that you're here with us this evening for some time with John Pavlovich. I'm going to introduce John in just a few moments, but before we get started, I want to ensure that you're all very comfortable in our space. Should you need to use the restroom, there is one in the foyer to the sanctuary here just through the first set of glass doors. In addition, there are ladies' and men's rooms. If you go out both sets of doors to the left and wrap around kind of on the other side of this brick wall, there are men's rooms and a women's room as well. Let's see. Following our talk, we hope you're going to linger with us. We have some bubbles. We have a little bit of food for you, a light reception. And so we hope you'll stay. John will be signing some books. Merchandise sales will pick up again after the talk. If anyone missed an opportunity to get a book or a t-shirt, those will all be happening out in our foyer. It is my joy and privilege here at Transfiguration, where we seek to live into our calling to seek and serve Christ in all persons as an open and welcoming Christian community. It is my delight and my pleasure to welcome John Pavlovich this evening to speak with us. John is a writer and an activist. He is a powerful Christian minister. He's from Wake Forest, North Carolina. In the past 4 years, his blog, Stuff That Needs to Be Said, has taken off like wildfire. I'm sure many of you are familiar. If you have not yet read any of the stuff that needs to be said, it needs to be said, so go and read it. John is a 20-year veteran of church ministry, and so he understands what we're about in this place intimately and what you all are about in your churches as well. He's committed to equality, to diversity and justice, both inside the church and outside the church. In 2017, he released his first book, A Bigger Table, and he'll be speaking with us about that this evening, about that subject of building a bigger table and the importance of hospitality. Since then, he's published two other books, Hope and Other Superpowers, which I'm holding here, my own copy of that, and a new publication called Low, an Advent devotional that examines less that neat and tidy side of the Advent season, the manger and the angels and all that glorious stuff, but some of the things that take place to the side of those scenes, to the side of all the hubbub in our own lives. People come to Advent with a variety of feelings. Grief, a need to serve, a lack of self-worth. And he examines in Low how we can prepare to welcome Jesus into the world when we're not necessarily coming at it from a high place, approaching Jesus from a low place. Just to give you a flavor, I feel like I don't need to give this crowd a flavor of John, but just this past week on Thursday, I was taken by the words that you published in your blog, John, and your longstanding commitment for social justice and for love of others is really manifest in what I'll call your credo. I mean, you wrote a series of statements about what you believe, and I'd like to share a little piece of that with you just to prime the pump for what you'll hear tonight. John writes, "I believe in full LGBTQ rights. I believe we should protect the planet. I believe everyone deserves health care. I believe all religions are beautiful. I believe the world is bigger than America. I believe to be pro-life means to treasure all of it. I believe whiteness isn't superior and is not the baseline of humanity. I believe there is enough in this world for everyone. Enough food, enough money, enough room, enough care. If we use our creativity and unclench our fists." So would you unclench your fists and join your hands together in welcoming John Pavlovich. So glad you're here. Thank you.
Wow. I don't know if you know that I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan. Because I wouldn't have gotten that reception. Oh, I am so grateful for your presence tonight, friends. You don't know the joy that this gives me. Doing the work that I do, it's really, I have the data that tells me that people are reading the blog. So intellectually I understand it, but it's really difficult on a daily basis to connect that data to flesh and blood human beings. And so when I step into a new town and all of a sudden you show up looking as beautiful as you do, it gives my heart such joy. So thank you for being present. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here because that you're a once in history, never to be repeated creation. And I'm also glad you're here because it reminds me that you're not bots on my social media profile. Right? You actually are people. You actually exist. Tonight is exciting, right? And it is not exciting because I'm here. It's exciting because humanity has never been arranged in this specific configuration in the history of the planet. And it never will be again. We are never going to all share the same space and time. And so we get to do that tonight. And I'm just overjoyed at what's going to happen. Tonight, you may not even know why you're here, but you are already renovating the people around you. Your interactions with everyone have already changed what's going to happen tonight. And tonight, what we do is unprecedented and what we do is historic. And if we do this correctly, what happens in this room will alter the world outside of this room, which is what we want, right? I mean, we want to have a great experience together. We want to have a moment when we share something intimate and beautiful. But if it does nothing to change the world outside of this room, then we've wasted this time. And so I want you to be thinking, what am I to do when I leave this place? Now, we have so much that we can talk about over the next 6 hours that we have together, right? I'm sorry, yeah, the doors are locked. Call your babysitters. It's going to be a while. And, you know, I think about as you walk in, I look at you or I may meet you and I think, why are they here? What brought them out into this place? And so it's not a rhetorical question. Would a couple of you just share with me why you're here tonight? Yes.
It's not all about you.
Right.
It's great to be around people who are like-minded. And I just get so much out of you. Because too many Christians, including myself, don't have the courage to say what needs to be said. Because I want to make sure that Jesus' message is all inclusive.
Okay.
But you have the bravery and the honesty to say that.
Thank you. No, and so, thank you. So you are excited, though, to be around like-minded people, or as I say, like-hearted people. And you get to sort of exhale when we're together because all of a sudden we realize, wow, family, look at that. I'm not alone and I'm not crazy. And if I'm crazy, I'm in really good company, right? Why else are you here? Yes, ma'am.
You're the reason that I found my sister, Mama Bears.
So you found your sister, Mama Bears, through me, through the writing. And the Mama Bears are moms of LGBTQ plus children, and they have a fantastic organization. They do subversively beautiful work in the world. So I'm so glad that you're here. Oh my gosh, all my friends are here tonight. Yes.
You inspired me as a writer to stand up and be loud and be noisy and have my opinions and to take them out there in a public forum. I thank you so much.
Thank you. So I inspired you to be noisy and loud. I don't know how that happened. You're getting the wrong message from the writing. Yes.
I am also inspired. And for my Facebook friends who get tired of hearing me, who have little no worth, I present you to them. And they seem to love the message because so many of them feel the same way, but I'm not bold enough
okay.
to stand up and say those things.
So sometimes you use the words as another way of reaching people or another conversation starter or to say, huh, how about that, right? Troublemakers. If you're not going to listen to me, listen to John. I love that.
Well, to piggyback on her, it's not just the boldness, but it's the clarity. You've been speaking my mind and my heart for the last 3 years.
Thank you.
Every time you post something, I just automatically forward it.
So every time I write something, you automatically forward it. Well, thank you. My wife automatically deletes it. I don't know what the... She's heard, she just has heard these stories many times before. Well, the thing is, we could all share stories about why we're here, and they're all equally valid. One thing as we begin, this room is set up the way most churches or other organizations are. A lot of people facing one direction and one person standing here, which artificially elevates them. So what I'm going to share with you tonight is my story. It's no more valid or beautiful or worthy of attention than your own, and that's what the message should be that you take away with tonight. But I do want to tell you a little bit about why I'm here not just in this church tonight, but why I do the work that I do. I do it because I've been a pastor in the local church for almost 25 years now, and I have seen beautiful things doing that. I have had a front row seat to moments that I find life-affirming and enriching and beautiful and powerful and destination-changing, but I've also seen a lot as a local pastor that has grieved me. I've seen things that have caused me to mourn in my church and in the church in general. And I want people to hear a different voice of faith than the one that may have the microphone right now in our country. I'm here because I believe every person has the same inherent worth, and there are so many people leading churches and leading our government who don't understand that. So I want to stand alongside the loud lovers of all people. And I think you're here tonight, aren't you? Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm here because I've been a Christian for most of my life. I will tell you I'm still a Christian today, but I have more and more difficulty claiming that because I know what that word aligns me with in the minds of so many people, right? I know all the baggage. I know all the wounding that comes along with it. So I am trying to be an expectation-defying Christian. I want people to meet me and say, I didn't realize Christians were that anymore. And I'm here because if I'm honest, this is the most toxic, most diversity-resistant, most compassionless movement in my lifetime. And I believe silence in the face of it is participation in it. And my faith teaches me not to be silent. And I bet you're in that space too. I'm here because life is heavy and it's difficult on its best days, right? Even when all the little stuff breaks just right, when you open up the refrigerator door and there's still milk left, hallelujah, right? Days when you have a really good hair day or a really good lack of hair day. Right? When you feel comfortable in your own skin, even then, when you hit all the green lights, even then, life is heavy and it's difficult. And I believe that spiritual community and leaders in spiritual community should not place burdens on already burdened people. And I want people to leave lighter than when they met me. And so I want to be a source of lightness here on the planet. Now, it's so great to speak with you because we have had a very artificial relationship up until this point, right? You probably didn't even realize I could speak. See, I would write words and I place them out into the world and then you read those words. And we know that the written word is fraught with difficulty, right? It's really easy to misunderstand the written word, not to get nuance of the written word. I was at a conference and I gave my talk and a woman came up to me afterward and she said, "You know, I've been following your blog for a while." And I said, "Thank you." And she said, "Yeah, after hearing you speak today, I don't think you're as much of a jerk as I thought you were from your writing." That was Mother Rebecca, actually. So that was... No. We've worked it out. No, that was not her. So this is a beautiful opportunity to have a conversation tonight, to talk about the deepest contents of our hearts and know that it's okay here. Now, we may not all agree politically in this room tonight. We may not all agree theologically, and I'm sort of hoping that's true. Because if we don't all agree politically, if we agree on everything politically and theologically, the table is still far too small in this room. So if you feel some unrest tonight, or you feel some tension, you feel a little bit of anger, rejoice. It means you have been exposed to diverse thought. But this is a night where I'm just grateful to be with people because I know that you care about the things that I care about. And sometimes just to know that you're not the only one who feels the way you feel is medicinal, right? And that's why we're gonna make one another more well tonight. I'm going to share a little bit of my story if I could. Some of you know it, but I want to give you a little bit of perspective about how I became the kind of pastor that I am today. I grew up in Syracuse, New York, in a fairly traditional Italian Roman Catholic family, which means I was raised on gluten and guilt. A lot of pasta, a lot of repentance. I still have a healthy appetite for both of those things. And I had two stories starting out, because we're a product of our stories, right? And the first story I had was of a family who was for me. The people who raised me told me I could do anything and be anything, and they were in my corner. They said, "John, it's America. You can grow up to be president because anyone can grow up to be president." Anyone, right? But, you know, they told me that they were for me, that they were in my corner. Not everyone in this room had the story of a family who was for them. And I also had a God story growing up. And in my God story, God was, and God was good, and this God was massive and made everything and yet knew me intimately and loved me completely. And it was, and I still believe is, a true and beautiful story. So I had these two great stories of a family who was for me and a God who loved me, and yet I inherited some false stories too. I inherited false stories about people of color. I inherited false stories about gay people. I inherited false stories about Muslims. And in all the false stories that I inherited, something in those stories told me I was just a little bit more deserving of the love of this great big God than they were. And see, the false stories I inherited weren't the product of adults trying to mislead me. It's just the adults who raised me were only around people who looked and talked and thought and believed and worshipped and loved the way that they did. And you know that if you're only around people who look and talk and think and believe and worship and love the way that you do, your table's going to naturally be small, right? You're naturally going to rely on false stories for millions of people who don't look and talk and think and believe and worship and love the way that you do. But so if I had stayed there in Syracuse, New York, in my little bubble, well, it was a snow globe. It was Syracuse, right? I'm currently melting here. If I had stayed there geographically, I would have grown up to be a decent human being, but I would have had far too small a table for the God I said I believed in. And I believe that God gave me a gift, and that gift was the city of Philadelphia. Now, I know what you're saying. How could that be? We've seen those Eagles fans. There's no way that's a gift from God. Have you ever gone to a carnival? There's a game with a group of fish bowls. You've got a ping pong ball, and you try to throw the ping pong ball in, and if you get it into the fish bowl, you get to bring home a fish in a little Ziploc baggie, right? And you know if you have an aquarium, you can't just toss the fish in because the system shock will overwhelm the fish and you'll have a dead fish. When I arrived in the city of Philadelphia, it was like I was dropped from 30,000 feet into the city of brotherly love. Because I lived right in the heart. I was going to a scholarship for graphic design and illustration. And I'm there in the streets of Philadelphia and I experienced diversity that I had never seen in my life. And I saw poverty that I never really knew existed. But I didn't see diversity and poverty through intellectual exercises or political debates or theological discussions. I experienced diversity and poverty in the form of names and faces and lives and people that I grew to love and live alongside. And those stories started to change me. Do you know if you get truer stories about people, it will change your heart toward them? Right? You may not like them more, but you will know them more and you'll see them as fully formed human beings. And those stories started to change me there in Philadelphia. So much so that I got home on my first Thanksgiving break and I was about to talk to my father. And you know when you have a life experience that changes you and you try to share that experience with someone who has not had that experience and they're not ready for you? And you do to that person what I was about to do to my father, which was bulldoze them with your revelation. Because I saw my father there and he had no idea it was coming. And we were having a conversation not unlike many we'd had before. And the title of the conversation might have been Poor People and Why They're Poor. And he started to talk and I decided this is my moment. And I leaped in and I shared all the things that I'd seen and all the stories that I had acquired and all the wisdom I'd taken in the last 2 months, right? All the smarts I had gotten about the world, and I began to just preach and preach and preach, and there was a voice in the back of my head that sounded like my own that said, keep going, you're doing great. And I said, I am. And my father began to shake his head and smile. And if you're trying to convince someone of something and they shake their head and smile, you're not doing well, right? And he said, oh, John, you've turned into a real bleeding heart. And I was still preaching, right? So I just shot back. I'd rather have a bleeding heart than a dead one, Dad. And the fact that I'm alive, like here today, means my father was much more compassionate than I gave him credit for. But the truth was that the stories were changing me. And I try to say that during that time, I feel like that God expanded my table and rewrote my false stories and prepared my heart for ministry. But see, for ministry, that was like 10 years away. Because at this time, I was a hopeful agnostic. I was an agnostic with suspicions, right? I was hoping this was going to work out, but I wasn't really sure what held it all together. And I remember being sort of pulled back into the church. My wife and I, at the time, she was my fiance, we wanted to get married, but we're in a new area, and we didn't have a connection to a local church, so I did something really spiritual. I looked in the Yellow Pages. Young people, you can Google that later. And so we find this little, like, most of the churches didn't call us back, or they had, you know, hoops we had to jump through. We had to be members for a certain amount of time. But I remember one United Methodist pastor, her name was Susan May. I didn't realize a woman could be a pastor. That was revelatory. I still have the post-it note with her name and the time that we were going to have a phone conversation. Because she said, tell me a little bit about you. And I told her about our story. And she said, well, why don't you come down to our community and see what we're about? And if you feel good there and comfortable, then we'll talk about doing your wedding. And so we went there. We fell in love with this little country Methodist chapel of like 75 people. And we got married there 27 years ago. And then 3 months after that, I'm going to scoot you over for one moment if you don't mind. Just so you're, I'm in church 3 months after getting married, and I'm thinking very spiritual thoughts. Like, I wonder where we're going to eat today, right? Or, I hope the Eagles offensive line can handle the Giants' defensive pressure. Very spiritual. And a woman taps me on the shoulder, and she's smiling, and she says, John, I've been thinking about you and praying about you, and I think you would make the best youth leader. And I smiled and thought to myself, I know you. You're the current youth leader. Right? Because she had paid her debt to society. She had done her time. She was getting out on good behavior. And she needed a sucker. No. She needed a minister of the Lord. And she said, would you want to hang out with some teenagers tonight at our youth meeting? And I said, what could that change about the complete trajectory of my life? Do you ever have those pivot point moments in your life when you say yes to something and it alters everything, right? Those pivot point moments, you say that yes, and it's disguised as an ordinary moment. And if you knew the gravity of the situation, you would run screaming or fall on your knees praying because it was about to change everything. And I remember that night walking down into this moldy church basement with Civil War era furniture, leaky bean bags because youth programs have to have them. And there's like 6 or 7 kids there, and everything in my life changed. I discovered some things in those first couple of hours and weeks. One was that I had a heart for teenagers, for middle school and high school students, for that turbulent time of adolescence when no other rational adult wanted to be there. I did. I was like a demented storm chaser. Like, that looks horrible. Let's go there. And I started to find this love for students. And as I began teaching them about a faith that I did not yet really have, my faith began to grow. So much so that I ended up working at the church part-time and then full-time, finally leaving my job, doing what I was supposed to be doing the thing I'd prepared my life to do. And then a few months later, our son Noah was born, first child on either side. I got an offer to go down to Charlotte, North Carolina to work at a big mega church there. I'd already had to have a talk with my wife about leaving my job to go into ministry to begin with, which she had just bravely said, I think you should, right? And I said, well, I had a whole PowerPoint prepared for you. That was really easy. And so I asked her, you know, we're going to have to move from our families in the Northeast to go down to Charlotte where we don't have any family. And she said, yeah, I think you should. And I said, would you stop being brave, because I'm trying to be a coward here and it would help me if you would offer some resistance. But we went down to Charlotte, North Carolina, 10 years after being in Philadelphia, and that's 2005, friends, and if you had met me that around that time, I was super Christian, mega pastor man. Our church of 2000, I was speaking, I was writing music for the church that we were recording and singing. We had a youth ministry of 350 students. We were going into the community and doing radical work. We were doing mission trips without a destination, where I took 40 students and we just drove for days and didn't know where we were going. We were just there to help people. Life-giving, amazing work. I loved being a pastor. I loved all of it, and it really worked for me until it didn't work for me anymore. Have you ever had something work for you and then it no longer does? You get older, that happens anyway, right? But if I was super Christian mega pastor man, I experienced two pieces of kryptonite, and I bet you're here tonight and you have experienced them as well. The first was that I started to have theological questions. I started to question our treatment of LGBTQ people. I started to question the existence of a loving God who would send people to hell. I started to question what I even thought about the scriptures. Now, you're really super spiritual people, so you've never had any of those questions, right? But you know the existential crisis, right? You know the difficulty of those questions. And it's one thing to have those questions as a civilian Christian, as a pew sitter. But to be super Christian, mega pastor man, and to speak with authority, to be expected to say, this is who God is, this is what God says, and this is how you're supposed to live based on what that God says. And I started to have a problem because I had these theological questions, and it was creating a tension in me. See, there was the person I felt called to be the more I followed Jesus, the more I read what he said and did, and the pastor I was expected to be. The pastor I was expected to be couldn't say some of the things that I was being called to say. And I started to feel that I wasn't authentic any longer. But I could preach around those things. See, what ministers do is when we doubt, we only preach the things we're really confident about. So I could talk around them. I could not deal with those. But the problem was I had a second piece of kryptonite. And it was that 10 years into ministry, 10 years after Philadelphia, my table had gotten really small again. Do you know the church can sometimes shrink your table? Because now I was only around people from my church and only people from my church who believe what I believed. And only around people from my church who believe what I believed, who I liked, which was a small list. Like my wife and my dog. And the dog didn't even say anything, so she may not believe what I believed. And I started to lament that I was a better person before I was a pastor. So I started to intentionally seek out diverse community again and hear the stories of LGBTQ teens and talk with Muslim families and speak with atheists. And they were telling me a story over and over again. They're saying, John, this church thing that you're a part of, it doesn't seem like it just wants to exclude me. It seems like it's actively out to harm me. And so that's rough, right? When you're a super Christian mega pastor man, to hear that you're part of the problem, plus you're having theological questions. So I had two choices. I could either not deal with the questions and not listen to the stories of marginalized people who are telling me that the church is toxic toward them, or I could lean into all of it. I was writing a blog. I could start writing it. I could start preaching it to my people, talking about it to my students. So I decided with all of it, with the questions and with the stories of vulnerable people, I decided to lean in. I had started at a new church in Raleigh, North Carolina, and only 5 months into my time there, I heard God calling me to leave that church. Came in the form of my pastor's voice saying, "You're fired." I'd like to say it was in my quiet time. And there was a voice that sounded like Morgan Freeman. And he said, "Go." But it was actually at a Starbucks on a Thursday afternoon with a group of total strangers hearing my life fall apart. And friends, even though I knew it was coming, and even though I really realized I would probably preach myself out of a job, it was devastating. It wasn't just losing a job, but pastor was who I was. I was caregiver. I was a lover of people. And even my idea of God was skewed now because I thought, God, I know people suffered in the Bible, but we had a deal. I serve you and you make life easier for me. And I was really broken up. This was a really difficult time for, you know, 3 or 4 hours. If you had seen me that afternoon, it was really difficult, right? I ate emotionally. I cried. I watched black and white movies on TV because that's what I do. And I remember having this sort of tear-filled conversation. I was talking out loud and thinking, for the first time in 17 years, I don't have a place to go. I don't have a community to be part of. I don't have anyone to pastor. And then a voice in my head that sounded like my own, but happier, said, John, do you know what the great news is? For the first time in 17 years, you don't have a church to go to. You don't even have to go to church. You don't have to, John, represent anyone else's faith convictions but your own. And friends, I realized I'd been given a gift by being Released is the spiritual term they say when they fire you. We're releasing you. We're giving you the spiritual gift of unemployment. But I realized I could now ask anything and say everything. And do you know when you can ask anything and say everything in your relationship or your identity or with your family or with your career, you never want to give that up, right? And so I found this authentic place for the first time in all that time or since the very beginning, I could just be myself as a follower of Jesus. So I started asking questions. Did I still want to be a Christian? Did I still want to be a pastor? Did I still want to serve in the church? And if I did, how would things be different going forward? So I went back to my tradition. I went back to the table ministry of Jesus. All those places where in the gospel stories, Jesus uses the table, the act of breaking bread with someone, the act of sharing a meal with someone to let people know they're seen and heard and loved and respected. And the more I read these stories, the more I saw the diversity of Jesus' table guest list, right? He dines with priests and with prostitute. He dines with the religious elite and the street rabble. He dines with his disciples and he dines with his adversaries. And I don't know about you, but I'm not in a hurry to dine with my adversaries lately. I will have coffee with my adversaries because I can just put a lid on it and get out. But what I found was the table of Jesus was a place of turbulence because he was always welcoming those who were not yet welcomed. And he was always disturbing those who already felt like they owned the table. And I love those stories, and my favorite is told by all four gospel biographers. You may have heard the story. I'll paraphrase it for you in 90 seconds. Jesus is on a hillside preaching, and like most preachers, he's gone long, right? And his students say, Jesus, you've been preaching. You started on Saturday. It's now Sunday. Chick-fil-A is closed. These people are hungry. They're never going to be able to eat. What are we going to do? And Jesus says, well, feed them. And they begin to make excuses. And Jesus says, well, we'll just get together what you can. And they collect some bread and some fish. And the story goes that Jesus blesses it. And he gives thanks for it. And then they feed thousands. Most of you are familiar with that story. And I used to read that story as a how story. And it used to really mess me up. Because I'd think, okay, some bread and some fish, thousands of people. I've got two kids and one box of Kraft macaroni and cheese. And I cannot make this work. So how did they do it? So the mechanism of the miracle used to trip me up, but now in this sort of new space, fired me, said, I want to read this story as a who and a what and a why. And the who was Jesus, and the what was Jesus feeds people, and the why, it's because they're hungry. Because what became revelatory about that story was not even what Jesus does, but what Jesus doesn't do in that story. There is no spiritual gifts assessment test. There is no altar call. There is no offering taken. There is no comparing of dating history or political affiliation or life experience. No one has to prove that they're worthy to be fed, right? Their hunger and Jesus' compassion for them makes them worthy. And all of a sudden it was like, it was so clear what I wanted to do. I wanted just to feed people who are hungry. And so I started thinking about what that could look like. And then I went back to my family tradition too. I told you I grew up Italian. Growing up Italian, we had a home, but we didn't need a home. The home was just an expensive, elaborate covering for the kitchen. Right? We had a table in the kitchen, and that's really where we lived. And I had my seat and my spot, and I can remember that table. Around that table, we argued, and we gossiped, and we entertained, and we laughed, and we told stories, and we ate, and we ate, and we ate. And I can remember understanding belonging at that place, right? And that's what I wanted to give people because I feel like that's what Jesus gave people at the table. He said, you don't have to prove your worth to me. And no one ever left Jesus with less dignity than when they arrived. So that's what I started to think about. How would this work? And I started to write about the bigger table and I started to write this book. And you may have read it. If you haven't, the idea is just that we can create redemptive spiritual community with disparate people. We don't have to agree, but we have to agree on how we treat them. We see their value. We assign value to them and we welcome them. And hospitality means that we celebrate them. Because you know when you're in a place when you're celebrated. And you know when you're in a place when you're just tolerated. And you know when you're in a place when you're not wanted, and no one has to tell you any of that with words, do they? So I wanted something that would be celebratory. And diversity that actually reflected the world, because often in spiritual community, we have a sanitized diversity. It's a diversity that maybe the people who have been at the church for a long time are comfortable with, or maybe the diversity is just a product of where people live in the neighborhood. But we don't often have true diversity, because when someone shows up and they're too messy, or they're too needy, or they're too left, or they're too right, then we all of a sudden we don't want them there necessarily. And the bigger table is going to be built on authenticity, when you could say exactly who you were and what you believed, and none of that would be a deal breaker. The idea that you could just believe what you believe, not believe what you don't believe, and we would just be okay with that. And the last part of the bigger table was a gender-free relationship, which basically means I'm not here to fix or change or save or renovate you. I'm here to sit with you in your story and celebrate what God is showing me through your life and celebrating life alongside you. And it seemed really simple, and it seemed like it was easy. And I wrote a book, and I published it, and I'm grateful. It's reached a lot of people. And I wrote that book in 2015. Yeah. I wish you could have seen me back then. I was effervescent. I was optimistic. I believe I may have looked like a young Brad Pitt. I don't know what happened. But the truth is, I wrote this book and I mean every word of it, and it's my aspiration, and yet we then had a campaign season, and then we had an election, and we've had a presidency, and I'm having to face the reality that maybe I don't want the table as big as I thought I wanted it. Because there are people that I am hesitant now to welcome, and I can tell myself a lot of great stories about why that's true, and some of them are true. But I'm facing my own inconsistency, my own fraudulence, and my own hypocrisy, and I want to name that because it's okay, because there's a tension at the bigger table. The tension is, how do I welcome people that I disagree with without sanctioning the things that they do to people that I love, right? I want diversity, but I don't want to sacrifice marginalized people on the altar of my ceremonial diversity. So I know that those tensions are there, and I've been traveling the country for the past 2.5 years talking about these things. And when I travel into places like this, I don't see myself as an author. I see myself as partly a pastor, but I also see myself as a war correspondent. Because I sit with you, and you tell me stories, and I say, tell me what's happening on the ground so I can tell the folks back home. Because I want people to know the things that they don't know. I want people in other parts of this country and other parts of the world to hear a perspective that they may not hear, and sometimes that's yours. So I sit with your stories, and I listen for the places your voice breaks, and I see the tears that come, and I sense your grief, and I realize how tired you are, because it's exhausting to give a damn, isn't it? Like, to be a person of compassion in a time and a place when compassion is in such great demand. You wake up every day and you push back against predatory politicians and toxic systems and corrupt legislation and human rights atrocities and leadership failures in the church and presidential tweet tantrums and your aunt and uncle who you don't recognize anymore. It's exhausting. The volume and the relentlessness of the threats can wear you out, or have you noticed? Because you're carrying a lot into this room tonight. You're carrying the big realities that you've seen, the realities of systemic racism, the realities of white privilege, the realities of homophobia, the realities of gender disparity, all these things. You're carrying around that big stuff, and that's heavy enough, but you're carrying around something else. You're carrying around the names and faces and lives and stories of people who you love, who you know are under more duress than ever. And these big realities and these individual stories, you know what they do? They start to pile up on you, and they reside in your tired shoulders, and they reside in your elevated heart rate, and they reside in the knot in the pit of your stomach that returns every morning when you check the news, or you look on Twitter, or you walk out into your community, or you step out into your living room and you realize how much pain there is and how little compassion you feel you have left. Whether you're an activist or a minister or a caregiver or a parent or just a concerned citizen of the planet, You feel the effect of these days, right? The heaviness, the fatigue catches up to you. See, you try to stay busy and you try to stay active. And then all of a sudden, when you quiet yourself, all that grief catches up to you. And what I love about this space right now is we can stop, we can breathe, and we can let the grief and the fatigue catch up to us. And it's okay. Because I think you're here because you're one of the damn givers. I think you're here because compassion is the thing that fuels you through the world, which is actually the heart of Jesus. All the work that Jesus did, Jesus disturbed a lot of people, friends, but he never did it to damage people. He always did it to protect people. Right? His motivation was not to hurt the oppressors. His motivation was to care for the oppressed. So it's in that sort of urgency that we meet tonight. I've been talking for a while, and I'd like to hear you talk for a little while. I think we have microphones. Do we have microphones? If we don't, okay. Right, here we go. If I could have someone to... Reverend, thank you, Casey. If you have a question right now, just give me some things you're thinking about. What's stirring up in your heart? What frustrations are you having? Share some things with me.
It's hard living in Texas.
North Carolina is no picnic either. So, what I find as I travel is everyone is feeling it. I go to the rural mountains of Georgia. I go to Southern California. You know, I go to Minneapolis. Everyone feels whatever their true was before, it's gotten harder because there's the cruelty that we see. And part of what we have to do is figure out how to sustain the collateral damage of all the grief and keep going. You know, I'm going to share a little bit about my journey through sort of relational grief and grief over the nation, and even grief about my faith tradition, because I think we have to translate that into something other than just grief. What I would say to you is it is hard to live in Texas. But if you'll turn around, there's a whole lot of people here who will live alongside you. And that's what I mean. Community is medicinal. And I'm really grateful for the time we're having tonight. And I want to talk to you after and take selfies and hear stories. But I would also really love it if you would meet 10 to 15 people here, exchange numbers, and meet and realize how are we going to alter Dallas in a way that is going to blow people's minds, because I'm going to leave, right? So use one another as a support. But yes, I can imagine. I took a bus tour through parts of Texas on something called Vote Common Good. It was an idea to talk to white evangelicals and say, you can vote your faith and actually not vote the way you've always voted. In fact, now you probably should. And our bus broke down in the middle of a truck stop somewhere in the middle of somewhere Texas. I don't know where it was. It was dry and barren. And we had a bus with a big graphic that said, flip Congress on it. I have stories I would tell you about those experiences, but none of them can be repeated in a church. So I have a window into how hard it is. What else is on your mind? Right back there. Casey's going to get an aerobic workout. Get your steps in.
I'm the new youth minister here at Transfiguration.
Wait, what did she say? What did she?
I'm the new youth minister here at Transfiguration.
Oh, okay. Bless you.
Yes. So,
no, I'm not taking that gig.
When I started, though, I interviewed the youth council and asked what they wanted out of a youth program. And the first thing one of them said was that they wanted to be able to discuss what's going on in the news.
Okay.
And what's going on in our world. And I feel a tension between giving them the hope of Christ, right, mm-hmm. and the reality of what's going on. And I just wondered if you had any words of advice or...
So giving students hope and reality together? Okay. Ha! Well, so it's funny, you know, I'll share a little bit toward the end, but I people said, you know, you've spent a whole year writing a book on hope. How did you do that? And I said, it was easy. You lie. You just think about what would a hopeful person say, and then you write that, right? but for me, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit as we go on, but the hope is easy to find. It's depending on what I focus on and what I choose to dwell on and what I choose to allow to stick to me. There is a lot that we can give young people. In fact, we can use young people as the example of where the hope is. We can look at the Parkland students. We can look at Greta Thunberg. We can look at the climate strikers and say, well, you know what? It's actually pretty darn amazing what's going on. And what I, with my students, I always, our students led the church. Our students were always on the front lines of everything. And all the adults said, oh, I guess this is where we're going, right? And I think that's something that you can really empower them to do. And as you share things that you may feel would make them hopeless, just say, this is an invitation to you to use all this stuff that we talk about.
Here with my good friend Lizzie, so we'll both talk. It is exhausting living while black, and it always has been. And it's even more exhausting now, because now white people are recognizing that living while black is exhausting, and they want you to explain it to them.
Yes.
It's hard enough to live it. I don't want to explain it. I want you to talk amongst yourselves, because you see it now. You can't avoid seeing it.
Right.
And if you don't see it, keep looking, because it's there.
Thank you.
So my question kind of goes along with that. I'm part of the LGBT community.
Okay.
And I think right now we're living in a time where there's a lot of hatred, and a lot of the hatred comes not only from people you don't know, but also people you do know. It's coming from your friends, your neighbors, your family members, and it's really hard to just overlook it and ignore it. And I know that it says you're supposed to love your enemies, and I don't know how to do that. So I was wondering, since you wrote this letter about how you would love your child if they were gay, I wanted to see if you had a suggestion on how you're supposed to love your enemies when they're telling you to go to hell and that you don't deserve to live and things like that.
Okay. Told you we were going to be here for 6 hours. Okay, thank you. Thank you both. So first, I want to address the first point. You know, I remember the day after the election. Our church at the time of the election spanned the racial diversity from white to beige and everything in between. But I have a couple of friends of color who were part of the church, and I remember talking to one woman, and I'm lamenting how upside down everything feels and how I feel like we're not being heard and the world is being taken by powerful people. And she said, well, welcome to being black. And I had a relationship with Teresa, so our conversations were natural. She knew I wasn't using her as a project to study culture. And part of the problem is a lot of the folks in this room, maybe, you may not have authentic relationships with vulnerable people, and you have to get those first, and then those conversations that are going to inform you are going to happen organically. But I can remember, you know, if you go to like a local cable provider and they say, if you know what, we can actually add phone and internet too, and we can package those things, and it'll be much cheaper than if you purchase them separately or from another vendor. You know, that packaging of deals is called what? Bundling, right? We love the bundle because we think we're getting away with something. We're something for nothing. And I turned 50 years old recently, and it took me far too many of those years to even begin to realize that as a white, cisgender, heterosexual man born in America and identifying as Christian, that I was born with a privilege bundle. I had been grandfathered in, or great-great-great-grandfathered in. The color of my skin and my gender and my profession of faith, they all gave me buffers against things that people experience on a daily basis. And so I've gone through a process of trying to learn. And there is a horror when you realize how much you didn't know. And so part of the challenge is for every one of us to use whatever bundle of privileges we have, because we all have some, is to leverage those, that bundle of privileges, in a way that lifts up people who have less than we do, right? And right now there is a feeling like all of a sudden for white people, oh, now it's actually hitting us too. So there's a shock to people, but yet the world has always been pretty rough. And there's always been injustice. It wasn't invented 3 years ago. Racism and homophobia and Islamophobia weren't invented by Donald Trump. They were just uncovered. And we've all seen it now. So there's a responsibility to leverage whatever currency that you have in your privilege and comfort and that. So the second question, how do you love people who are hateful and cruel? Good night. It's all the time we have. I'm sorry. So I tell the story in a bigger table of being with a lesbian teenager. We're in a coffee shop in Houston, Texas, and I'm explaining the bigger table, and as with my father, there's a voice in my head saying, you're being very convincing, and she said, John, this all makes great sense, and I said, thank you. And then there was a pause, and she said, but how do I love him? And she pointed outside the coffee shop, and outside the window was Southern Baptist sign guy. He had a sign that said she was going to hell for who she was and how she loved. And he had a bullhorn and he was screaming horrible things. She said, how do you love him? And I wanted to phone a friend. And I said to her, there's only two things we can do to love sign guy well. First thing is we have to realize that he was not born sign guy. That he had a story as well of a family who was either for him or not for him. He had the story of a God who either loved him or did not love him. He had life experiences and words spoken into his life, and he had a self-esteem created or destroyed, and now he doesn't see any of that. He's just who he is when he shows up into our lives. And I said, even though we think of him as hateful because his actions are, he doesn't realize that. Right now, Southern Baptist sign guy thinks he's doing exactly what you and I are doing. He thinks he's listening for the voice of God and trying to respond faithfully to what he believes that voice is telling him to do because he doesn't want to get God angry. He wants to please God. So even though right now he's hateful to us, in his mind he thinks this is a redemptive act. So the only thing we can do to love hateful people is to realize that none of them realize they're being hateful while they're being hateful. I've never met a person who is taking part in racism who thought, I'm racist. I never met a homophobic human being who understood at the time the damage they were doing, because if they understood the damage they were doing, they wouldn't do that thing. So part of it is we have to confront the horrible behavior, but to realize that there is a human being and a story there still. And I bet there are people in this room, you don't believe what you believed 10 years ago. You don't have the same politics or the same theology. And if not, you're not growing. And so we do have to give people a chance to at least have the moments we've had of clarity or learning or wisdom where our opinion was changed. Because there are people you're thinking about right now who do have the ability to learn and grow and change. It just might not be in a timetable that's comfortable for us. But I mean what I said about not sacrificing vulnerable people on the altar of diversity. I tell people the bigger table doesn't mean you can say or do anything you want when you get there. It means that everyone's voice is heard and everyone is seen as fully human. And that's the only, after that, if you're going to see someone, some inherent part of a person, the way they, unchangeable part of who they are, that makes them less than to you, then you're not really at the bigger table. You're just there. I don't want to give you proximity to do more harm. Couple more.
Hello. Just along the same lines of kind of the same train of thought, I'm someone who was raised Catholic, very Catholic for 28 years of my life, and I had that same turmoil with coming out and marrying that with my Catholic faith at the time, and I chose to walk away from that. And I was kind of in the, I would say, the spiritual wilderness for about a year and a half until a friend invited me here to Transfiguration.
Okay.
And it's been deeply healing. It's been deeply powerful. It's been deeply life-changing. Because I realize now that there is a Christian faith and a Christian community that loves like Jesus truly did.
Yeah.
Like wholeheartedly. But I guess my question is, there's lots of people my age, both in the LGBT community and allies even, that are not, that have been so burned by Christian faith, so I would even use Christian with like quotes around it.
I'm a pastor, by the way.
so burnt out by the Christian faith and their experiences with Christian faith that the door is just super closed. And sure. How do you open that door or just tiptoe it and let them in? Because, I mean, I want to proclaim transfiguration from the rooftops, and I do, but that's not the way you get someone that has been so burnt and hurt and jaded by what they've thought was Christian for their entire lives back into this door.
Yeah.
So how would you challenge us as people in this room to reach out to those people that are seemingly unreachable by Christianity at this point because they've been so burned by it in the past?
Okay, thank you. Well, part of doing what I do, I think any responsible person of faith right now is fighting both with and for their faith tradition. Right? They're actually seeing the toxic things. They're trying to make sure that the system, the thing itself changes, and then they're trying to invite people to something that's life-giving for them. I don't worry too much about that for the simple reason that part of agenda-free relationship in the bigger table means I don't really care if you ever come to my church. I care that you have your humanity affirmed, that you connect with something that's greater than yourself, and that you see yourself as beloved. And what I think we do is the church needs to realize people coming to a building for an hour on Sunday may not be the thing that we eventually do because so many people don't have the muscle memory that we have. And so they're not even thinking that way. So the challenge is maybe how do you bring them, but maybe what do you do out in the world that builds a relationship with people so that they are part of your community without you needing to get credit for it, right? Because right now, I've been fortunate, right? The writing has reached millions of people. They see me as their pastor. I have a certain type of relationship with them. They are affirmed and they seek spirituality, and I don't have to count them as my people. I don't have to have them on a roll. So maybe they're going to get connected to a church like this. I hope they do. If you're here for the first time and you're thinking, I haven't been to church in 25 years, this is pretty great, come back on Sunday like I did and see how you feel about that. But I don't think we should feel the pressure to evangelize progressive spirituality. We just have to be who we are, love people well, and if they decide they're going to find their way here to a church, they will. So that's a little bit of that. One more, and then I'll talk for another 7 hours, and then we'll order takeout, and it'll be great.
I guess I have a problem in the workplace. You know, there are topics that are inappropriate to talk about, and I accept that.
Yeah.
But when I am around in church or in the world and my Christian friends, they will vote against their better good, or they will speak against their better good. They will sympathize verbally and vocally about things, but as long as it doesn't touch their world, they're okay.
Yeah.
And they're always the one who's first praying and asking God. And when I say to them, He's already sent the answer, it's us, then nothing is still getting done.
Yeah.
So I have a real problem that's what we're doing now. We're just waiting, and God has already given us the answer.
Love it. Love it. Okay, perfect segue. I'll get to some more questions in a little bit. So the question is, like, we know that it's difficult. We know the grief is there, right? We know that the compassion fatigue is there. We are optimists thinking about retiring, right? You know, and I found you get a little older, you realize your body changes, things happen, and they're different than they were before. So, you know, for example, I used to be able to be upside down, but I can no longer be upside down. Like, I used to do a flip off a diving board, actually a 1.5. If I tried to do a 1.5 off a diving board, the paramedics would have to be called in advance, right? Like, right now, if I used to be able to do a handstand. If I want to do a handstand now, I would need this row to assist me. In fact, I used to be able to go on roller coasters that go upside down, and I forget that I can't. Because I get to Disney with my kids, and we're looking up at a ride, and it looks really awesome, and it's colorful. And I say, wow, look at that. People seem to be having fun on that. And there's like an 8-year-old girl on that thing. And I wrote 2 books. Of course I can do that. Actually, I wrote 3 books. I can do that for sure. And then I get on it, I get strapped in, and we're all happy, and it takes off, and within 10 seconds, my brain says, I thought we talked about this. You know, I told you what would happen, and now you're going to pay because you didn't listen. I can't be upside down anymore, and yet I feel like the whole world is upside down right now. I remember thinking that the night of the election. I felt that way the day of the inauguration. I felt that way watching men march with torches through Charlottesville. I felt like the world was upside down when I heard our president treat them with kid gloves. I saw people stranded at airports. I started to feel everything was upside down. And I think you know that feeling, right? I think you understand that disorientation when everything feels upside down. I call it spiritual nausea. You know that something is not right and it's making you sick. I think you wake up and you say, I don't recognize certain people in my life anymore. There are people I used to rely on for wisdom and clarity and compassion, and I can't even talk to them. Or I think you see people who you know post on social media and it blows your mind because you don't recognize them anymore. I think you wake up 100 times a day and you think, has a huge portion of this country lost its mind or is it me? I have good and bad news, friends. It isn't you. It's good news for what it says about you, and it's bad news for the place and time in which you find yourself. Because the fact that you are grieving this means your faculties are intact. It means your mind is fully right. It means your heart is working properly. It means you have a soul doing what a soul is supposed to do, keep you deeply human in profoundly inhumane times. So if you are grieving and sick and hurting, rejoice. Because it means you still have humanity in you, and that's the most valuable thing that we have right now. If my wife Jen were here, she would tell you that I'm a pessimist. I don't like that term. I like to say that I'm prepared for the worst case scenario. I like to know how bad it can go so that I'm emotionally and practically ready when it all hits the fan. And I can remember the election was approaching in 2016, and I said, I came in one day, I made a proclamation. I said, I got a bad feeling. And my wife said, well, this is what you do. You get bad feelings. You have the spiritual gift of agitation. It's agita, for if you're Italian. And I said, I really got a bad feeling. I don't think this is going to go well. And my wife starts to show me the details, the facts, the polls. She said, it's going to be fine. And I said, thank you for trying. I said, in fact, here's my plan. Election day, I'm going to vote. And then at 8 p.m., I'm going to take half an Ambien and go to bed. I said, you have my permission to wake me up if we get good news. So I voted, took half an Ambien at 8 p.m., went to bed. Next thing I knew, I looked at the clock, it said 11:45. And I said, oh no. I remember walking out into the office and I saw my wife's face. And I just closed the door and went back into the room. And as Tuesday turned to Wednesday and the reality started to become reality, it started for our family, maybe not for you, but for many of you, what began a time of profound grieving. Not theoretical grief, not just figurative grief, but a true loss that felt like a death. We were grieving the big things, our idea of country, our idea of family. We were grieving our idea of America, of the church. And we were grieving the small and close things too. We started to grieve the post of our friends on social media. We started to grieve people who we saw at work the next day. We started to grieve what we heard our neighbors saying. And the problem is, friends, with grief, the way we normally grieve is our person we love dies. We lose them one time and we spend our whole lives grieving that one moment, processing that one moment. But this is a recurring grief. Right? Because every day there's something else. You look at immigration and you don't even have any time, and then there's a mass shooting you have to deal with. And then there's something else, some other assault, and you never get to sit and grieve anything fully. This is why you're so worn out. And with any grief, what we have to do is figure out, how do we move forward? What do we do with this? And this is your invitation. Because you're the people who care enough to actually show up on a Sunday night when there's a football game going on. I better not say that. Stay here. There's no football. It was canceled. But people say to me, John, you know, how do you find hope in all this? We know how bad it is. And I tell people that hope is not actually very difficult if I pay attention. A gentleman at a Q&A said, John, you know, there are two news feeds in my life. There's the news feed that is the news and Twitter and Facebook, and he said, if I watch that news feed, that will always give me strife and heartache and anger and violence, and I'll never feel hope as long as I look at that news feed. He said, but I have a second news feed. If I bring my head down and look at the place where I actually live, and I start to think about the stories of people with names and faces and lives and nonprofits and political groups and churches and friends, all of a sudden hope is actually easy because I have all the data I need. I just usually don't dwell on that. So part of what I want you to do is be thinking about as you seek to expand the table is to make sure you stock up all those good stories that should sustain you and can sustain you. There's enough work in this room. There are enough stories in this room that would allow us to say, well, there's great reason to be hopeful, right? Because it's been really worse than even Olympic-level pessimists like myself could have imagined 3 years ago. And yet, despite how stomach-turning it's been and how little sleep I've gotten and all the grieving I've done and all the worry lines I've acquired, all the wine I've consumed, all the expletives I've let fly, right? Despite all of it, I'm still hopeful because I see that the dam givers are still at work. I look every day and I try to say, who is doing something beautiful and redemptive and kind and compassionate and brave? And guess what? It's happening all the time. We just have to choose not to relent to the bad news. I bet you could think of stuff right now if I asked you, right? So the way forward is for you to decide, how can I step into that world that is full of pain and urgency and suffering and fracture, and what do I have that I can actually bring to bear on it? And you have a lot. So I want you to think about a couple of things. I talk about compassionate activism, that is movement that is inspired by empathy. I think that's the heart of Jesus. And it can actually look really, really simple. See, I'm assuming that you're part of either a faith community or a nonprofit or a political group or a community organization, a Facebook group, Free Moms Hugs, a Mama Bears, Moms Demand, something. I'm assuming that you're involved in that, but I want to talk to you about the actual life, the trenches of your individual life, because that's where your faith gets worked out to. And some simple things you could do to affirm that right now and expand the table. Do you know that family conversations have gotten difficult lately? Is that, or maybe it's just me. And when family conversations become difficult right now, I tend to do what is called in my family as the dip out. The dip out is something I perfected because I'm an introvert, even though I can speak in public. I get tired after a while, and so at a family gathering, I'll learn how to do this and smile and talk, and then slowly I'm here. And you don't even realize it, and then, oh, by the way, Pastor, and then see, I redirect, and then I'm here. What happens is people an hour later will say, John is, wait, where's John? Is he in the bathroom? No, I guess he's downstairs. No, John is home sleeping because I dipped out. I bet a lot of you dip out when the political conversations happen because you say, I can't do this anymore with these people. I want to suggest to you that part of expanding the table and part of your personal activism is stepping into those conversations one more time and trying to speak truth that maybe they will not hear from anyone else, because maybe you'll say it in just the right way this time, or maybe they'll be ready to hear you, and maybe that will be the thing that changes them. Now, it may go horribly wrong. If it does, let me know. I'll send you a t-shirt, right? But I want you to risk doing that, because at some point in time, someone contacted you, someone interrupted your story, someone overlapped your life, and they said something that changed you. You got a better story. I tell people all the time, there are a lot of good people with really bad stories about immigrants, about Christianity, about fear, all these things. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think they have social media here in Dallas, right? Yeah, they do. Put up your hand if you have at least one social media account, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Put up your hand if you have at least one account. And a lot of you have several. Okay, perfect. You're ready to begin your work of table expanding, people loving activism. Because you have something I didn't have growing up. You have hundreds, maybe thousands of people who have to listen to what you have to say. Until they unfriend you and block you, which they will. But I want to ask you what you're using that for. Are you using that wisely? Are you being courageous with your convictions on social media? I was talking to a woman at a Q&A in Missouri. She was about 75 years old, and she said, I have a great story for everybody. And we said, awesome. And she said, I have a friend on Facebook, an old friend. She posted something derogatory about people of color, a meme that I thought was incorrect, and I decided to tell her so on her Facebook page. And she said she unfriended me. I said, lady, I don't know if you know how good stories work, but that was horrible. We're all really depressed. And she said, actually, what was great is right before I was unfriended, I got a friend request from a mutual friend of ours. And she said, I approved it, and the woman messaged me and said, you know, I'm a Christian, but I've been totally losing my faith at the Christianity I see in the world. I thought there was no Christians left in the world who think the way that I think, and I saw your post on our mutual friend's page, and it encouraged me, and I wanted to reach out to you. It's important that you remember, your social media, you're not just talking to the person you're talking to, you're talking to an army of people looking on who are saying, I wish someone felt the way I feel. And you get to confirm for them. Now, it may go horribly wrong. There's a second t-shirt I would owe you if that goes terribly wrong for you. The third thing I want to suggest is that you begin to hear stories that are not your own. My whole progression of faith happened because I got truer stories about people. And many people in this room, someone said to me, John, you're just speaking at one of those progressive churches. You're just preaching to the choir. And I said, I don't know how many choirs you've met, but they all need some preaching to. And maybe the preaching that this choir needs tonight is we need to keep extending to people who I have a really hard time showing compassion for people who have no compassion. And there's an irony there that I don't like. But this morning I was talking at First Church about my friend Sally. Sally is inspirational. She's in her 60s. She's a white woman. She was conservative Christian. Her faith got more and more progressive. And when the election happened, she said, John, it broke my heart to see what people around me actually believed. So I decided I had to learn some things about them again. So she started setting up a Sunday lunch, and she eats lunch and plays bridge with women who agree on nothing with her theologically and politically. She said, I sought out people who are diametrically opposed to me. And we're all sitting there thinking, that sounds so beautiful. But it isn't. Because Sally messages me on Saturdays and she goes, if you still pray, pray for me because I got to go into Sunday. And you see what happened this week with the immigration and the guns and the impeachment? I got to talk with these people on Sunday. I can't do it anymore. But she told me recently, she said, I was starting to feel something actually change in one of these women. We were talking about the racial disparity in the country, and she said the woman started to tear up. And so Sally said, why are you crying? And the woman said, well, I just don't understand why God made other races. Right? And I said, did you tell her that if Adam and Eve existed, they weren't Caucasian? I said, did you tell her that the cradle of civilization didn't come with a Cracker Barrel? Now, Sally's better than me, so she didn't say any of those things. But she said, tell me more. And the woman said, if God hadn't made other races, then we wouldn't have this kind of disconnection and anger and violence. And so as I talked with Sally, I said, you know what we see in your friend? We see a person who is genuinely grieving about what they're seeing in the world, but they have a really bad story about why they think it exists. In fact, they see themselves as the baseline of race. So I said, that's a good person with a bad story. So part of what you need to do as you expand the table is to keep trying to listen to the stories of people to understand why they believe what they believe. And the last thing I want you to think about is I want you to share your story and use your voice. Sounds trite, it sounds easy, but here's why it's important. Your story is no less valid than the story that I've told you. I've been fortunate enough to reach people, but your story is worthy of books and blogs and interviews and people coming to see you. And you're so used to your own story, it feels ordinary, but it's actually something that can speak wisdom in other people's lives, be encouragement for other people. Your words can be the thing that people stand on to become courageous. And your voice, you've heard it in your head so long that it's just white noise to you. But your voice, when you speak it clearly, it can be medicine for others. I told you, you know, I wrote a blog post that was called If I Have Gay Children, which is the reason a lot of us have met, because everything in my life happened because of those 800 words. And I remember the day after, you know, I published them and they reached 500,000 people that day and several million the next day. And I'm on CNN the next day and I'm speaking, and underneath me it says John Pavlovitz, pastor. And it could have said unemployed and currently despondent. When I published that post, I had no job. I had no idea where we were going to live. I had no financial capital. I had no marketing team. I had no church family. I had about 800 words that meant something to me, and I put those words out in the world, and those words did a work that I could have never imagined. You have the same capability, so how dare you not think that it's full of hope? How dare you not see the positivity? So I want you to challenge you to do that, to use whatever it is that stirs in you and decide you're going to ask anything and say everything. I share the story about being this morning being at the Parkland Memorial in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm in the parking lot of a church in Raleigh the couple days after the shooting, and I was there because I wanted to be with like-hearted people. I wanted to be with people who were grieving. And I'm walking on this parking lot, and it's a memorial service. So we're there to lament life gone too soon. We're there to say this violence is happening again. And we're there to say, are we doing a mass funeral again? How are we doing this again? So it was heavy, but there was something else happening there. There was like a counterintuitive joy that I was feeling, because middle and high school students had planned this event. And they had t-shirts they'd made and signs that they had made, and they were handing out flowers and hugging people and giving them high fives. And I started to feel like I'm smiling in the middle of a memorial service, and it felt weird. And the service was powerful. 17 middle and high school students stood there. They each spoke the name of someone who had been killed. They released a dove in that person's name, and then they took a candle with that person's name on it. And those 17 middle and high school students walked through the streets of Raleigh with hundreds of adults following behind them. And middle and high school students gave the messages that day. And they spoke prophetically and they spoke powerfully. And as they spoke, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up and tears came to my eyes, because I realized they're doing something life-affirming in the face of death and ugliness and hatred. And one of the men stood up and he said, I'm really happy to be here. I'm not happy because of why I gather, but I'm happy because I woke up today looking for hope. And he scanned the crowd and he said, and here you are. And this is the truth, right? You came here frustrated and angry and wondering what's going to happen and who's going to save this thing. And you've already answered the question, right? My friend here said it. You are the answer to the prayer. You are capable of the activism. You just have to simply do it. There's a 16-year-old young girl named Greta Thunberg who has shown the world that it really just is about moving. You give a damn and then you do something, right? I have a good friend named Rod. He lives in Santa Rosa, California. I don't know if you know that area. It's really nice. And Rod invited me to his home, and it was overlooking the wine country there, and he invites me in, and I walk into his home. And if you've ever walked into a home and you feel like you should put on booties, like, wait a minute, this is not right. Should I shower before entering? And he showed me to my room, my guest room, and he had all the snacks that I like. Apparently, I talk about food on social media a lot. And he had books he thought I might read in the 3 hours I was going to be there. And he just said a little note that welcomed me, and he said, I want to give you some time just to relax and make yourself at home. I remember sitting in this room overlooking the rolling hills of California and thinking, this house is amazing. But the house wasn't the big thing. And the view was great, but the view wasn't the thing. The thing was the hospitality of my friend, who made me feel welcome in a place I'd never been to. And my friend Rod lost his home in the wildfires last year. And I called him the day it happened, and he said, John, it was the craziest thing. He said, it was 2 a.m. We were awakened, we had 15 minutes, we saved what we could, and then the whole place burned down, and I lost everything we've ever owned. But he said this phrase, right? We saved what we could. I want you to think about that phrase, and I want you to hold on to that phrase, and I want you to live with that phrase. We saved what we could. Because you can't change every political outcome, but you might be able to get involved in some races and some campaigns and change something, right? You can't help every spiritual community see the value of LGBTQ children, but you can change the communities that you choose to be part of. You can't help every white person see the reality of their privilege, but you got some white friends who you can wake up. You can't do, no one needs, the world does not need another jerk blogger. That job is taken. But you can do something that actually captures your once in history, never to be repeated story. Share your story and use your voice, because it's not great out there, but it's going to get better as you move into it. So yesterday, I flew from Raleigh, North Carolina, looking for hope. And here you are. So I'm going to close paraphrasing Jesus, because I hope he'd be okay with it. I'm going to say, blessed are the damn givers, for they will right side the world. Thank you for your time. I'm grateful for you. Be well.